10 meters.
That's roughly the length of a standard school bus.
Yeah.
Or maybe the width of a tennis court.
Okay, keep that distance in your head for a second. Now, picture this. You're standing on a dirt road. It is scorching hot. The air is thick with dust. And you're wearing a heavy blue helmet.
Right.
And exactly 10 meters away from you, a soldier from a foreign army isn't just holding a rifle casually across his chest. He is aiming it directly at you.
Wow.
And then he gives you a direct order to move.
I mean, that sounds exactly like the opening scene of a high-stakes war movie.
It really does.
But unfortunately, for the people we are talking about today, this isn't Hollywood. This is the reality of the last few days, specifically February 18th, 2026, right on the border between Lebanon and Israel.
And that is exactly where we need to start today. Welcome to our deep dive.
Mm-hmm.
We are taking the stack of reports from the International Association of Soldiers for Peace, the AISP, and the latest UN briefings for the week of February 16th to the 22nd.
Mm-hmm.
And look, usually when we talk about global conflict, we see headlines about politicians shaking hands or issuing threats from podiums.
Right, the high politics.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But today, we are ignoring the podiums. We are looking at the ground truth. We are looking at the mud, the dust, and the people actually trying to hold the line. And honestly, it was a really chaotic week.
It really was. If there is a theme for this week, it's the collision between mandates, what is written on a piece of paper in a nice air-conditioned office in New York, and physics, which is what is actually happening on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, physics is winning.
So we have three big buckets to unpack today to make sense of this chaos. First, we're going to look at that boiling point in the Middle East, specifically Lebanon, where the rules of engagement seem to be getting shredded daily.
Right.
Second, we have to talk about Africa. There is a silent, creeping catastrophe happening there that involves a hunger cliff and troops packing up to leave just when they are needed most.
And finally, we have the shifts. These are the surprises. We have diplomatic breakthroughs in places you would never expect, like Cyprus, and some massive logistical pivots regarding Gaza that involve thousands of Indonesian troops.
So let's jump right into bucket number one, the boiling point, UNIFIL and the Middle East.
UNIFIL, the United Nations interim force in Lebanon, their job, on paper, is to patrol the blue line, which is the boundary between Lebanon and Israel. They are the referees.
Hmm.
But based on the reports from this week, the players are starting to tackle the referees.
Let's go back to that incident I mentioned in the intro, February 18th, near Nakura.
Right. Nakura is significant because it's a major UN position. It's supposed to be highly secure.
Yeah.
The report details that an Israeli Defense Forces IDF soldier aimed a weapon at a peacekeeper who is only about 10 meters away from the perimeter fence.
I want to pause on that aiming part.
Mm-hmm.
Because in military terms, there is a huge difference between just holding a weapon and aiming it.
It is a massive escalation. It signals intent. It signals, I am prepared to shoot you right now. And the soldier ordered the peacekeeper to move.
Which completely flips the script.
Exactly. This reverses the power dynamic. The peacekeeper is there to enforce the line. If they are being ordered around at gunpoint by one of the parties they're supposed to be monitoring, the whole mission is compromised.
And looking at the AISP data, this wasn't just a one-off bad day, was it?
No, and that is the worrying part. The report calls it part of a pattern of intimidation and obstruction. We are seeing daily violations.
Right.
The IDF is crossing the blue line on the ground, and they are conducting airstrikes inside Lebanese territory. Resolution 1701, that is the UN mandate that is supposed to keep the ceasefire, is being tested every single day.
It feels like the line between being an observer and being a target is getting very blurry. But here is where it gets really interesting and, frankly, kind of terrifying.
Mm.
It is not just the active soldiers. It's the stuff they are leaving behind.
Yeah.
The silent killers.
Unexploded ordnance, UXO.
The reports from this week are nightmares. Peacekeepers in Sector East, that is the eastern part of the mission area, found rockets and launchers. Okay, that's bad. But then they found something else in the ruins of a house.
Anti-tank mines.
Yeah.
That detail really stood out to me. Think about the implication of that. Rockets are offensive. You set them up to fire them somewhere else. But anti-tank mines inside a ruined house.
That is defensive.
Meaning you are expecting a ground assault. You are turning a civilian structure into a bunker or a trap for heavy armor. It implies that the forces there aren't just passing through. They are digging in. They are preparing for a much uglier phase of ground combat.
And the peacekeepers are just walking right through this. On February 16th, a patrol near a place called Adais was warned by locals about something suspicious. They go check it out. And it's an explosive device connected to a detonator cord.
A detonator cord means it was rigged to blow. It wasn't just battlefield trash. It was a live trap.
And then we have the mystery substance incident.
February 6th.
Yeah, it was briefly mentioned in the summary, but it's so bizarre. The IDF dropped a non-toxic chemical substance near peacekeepers.
Well, that's the official line, non-toxic.
Right.
But put yourself in the boots of those soldiers. You are in a combat zone, and suddenly a cloud of gas or powder lands near you. You don't have a chemistry set to test it. You don't know if it's tear gas, smoke, or something lethal.
If you take cover, you panic.
Exactly. It effectively disrupts operations without firing a single bullet. It's a psychological weapon.
So the UN peacekeeping chief came out this week and reaffirmed the mandate, basically saying, we aren't going anywhere. But I have to ask, if there is no ceasefire to monitor, what are they actually doing?
They are bearing witness, and that is incredibly dangerous work. But I think it is important to contrast this chaos with another border nearby just to show that the system can actually work.
You're thinking of the Golan Heights.
Exactly. Amidst all this chaos in Lebanon, on February 23rd, the defense minister of Kazakhstan, Doron Kasanov, confirmed that his troops are fully deployed and operational.
139 Kazakh peacekeepers.
Right. They are with UNDOF, the Disengagement Observer Force in the Golan. And it is quiet. They are doing their patrols. They are reporting in. It's a stark contrast.
Because both sides want it to be quiet.
Exactly. In the Golan, the mandate is being respected by the parties involved. In Lebanon, the mandate is being ignored. It reminds us that peacekeeping only works if the warring parties actually want peace.
That is a really crucial distinction. Okay, let's unpack the second bucket. We're moving from the threat of bullets and mines in the Middle East to a completely different kind of threat in Africa.
The threat of scarcity.
The situation in South Sudan seems absolutely critical right now. The UN mission there, UNMISS, is dealing with a double whammy. Fighting is ramping up, and the money is running out.
I call this the hunger cliff. The report from the World Food Program, the WFP, dropped a bombshell this week. They said emergency food aid for South Sudan and Somalia, too, is going to halt by April 2026.
April. That is barely 2 months away.
Unless they get $95 million immediately. If that funding doesn't appear, the food trucks stop. And the timing couldn't be worse because violence is spiking at the exact same moment.
Yeah, let's talk about that violence. The report mentions clashes in Unity State.
Right, between the government forces, the SSPDF, and the opposition, the SPLA-IO. On February 19th and 20th, there was intense shelling reported in Pakur and Tom.
So imagine the human reality of that. You are a civilian. Artillery shells start falling on your village. You grab your kids, you run to a UN protection site or a displacement camp. You survive the shelling. But then the UN officials have to look you in the eye and say, we can protect you from the bullets, but we can't feed you past April.
It is a nightmare scenario for those peacekeepers. But amidst that grim news, I found one story in the report that I really thought was incredible. It's about the Rwandan peacekeepers in Melakal.
Oh, yes. The self-defense training. This is a fascinating adaptation.
It really is.
Because they aren't just standing guard with rifles. They are actively teaching women and girls hand-to-hand self-defense to counter gender-based violence.
It creates a layer of resilience. In these displacement camps, the threat isn't always a soldier with a mortar. Often it's local gangs or it's violence when women go out to collect firewood.
Right.
The Rwandan contingent is realizing they can't be everywhere at once. So giving these women the skills to defend themselves, that is empowerment in its rawest form.
It's smart. It's tragic that it's necessary, but it's smart. Now, if we look just a bit south of there to the Democratic Republic of Congo, the DRC, we see a massive security vacuum opening up. South Africa is packing its bags.
This is the end of an era. South African troops have been the backbone of the intervention brigade there for 27 years.
27 years. There are soldiers packing up who probably weren't even born when the mission started.
Exactly. And they are calling it a consolidation of resources.
Which is corporate speak for we ran out of money.
Pretty much. But let's be honest about the impact on the ground. It leaves a massive gap. The UN mission, MINUSCO, is scrambling to fill that vacuum. And they're trying to do it with empty pockets.
The numbers here are just staggering. The 2026 Humanitarian Response Plan for the DRC needs $1.4 billion to help 7.3 million people.
And as of February 2026, do you know how much they have actually raised?
It was something ridiculous.
10%. It is virtually unfunded. So you have a security vacuum because the South Africans are leaving, and a humanitarian vacuum because the world hasn't written the check.
It seems like withdrawal is the theme of the week in Africa. Well, except for Somalia. They pulled a reverse card, didn't they?
They did. ATMIS, the African Union Transition Mission in Somalia, was supposed to send 2,000 soldiers home. It was a significant strategic pivot, all planned out. But this week, they hit the pause button.
Why the sudden change of plans?
Fear of a security vacuum. They looked at the map and realized that if they pull out now, Al-Shabaab or other insurgent groups would flood into that space instantly. They are waiting for the new mission, AUSOM, to take over at the end of the year. It's an admission that the job simply isn't done yet.
So if we connect these dots across the continent, what are we seeing here?
We are seeing that tension I mentioned earlier, mandates versus money. Look at the other updates from the UN Security Council. They just extended the mandate for UNESFA in Abay until November 2026. They extended the MINUSCI mandate in the Central African Republic until November 2026.
So on paper, the missions go on. Keep doing the job.
Exactly. On paper, the world says, yes, keep the peace. But in reality, the checkbook is closed. We're extending legal authority while simultaneously experiencing funding crises that cut the physical resources needed to execute that authority.
That is a sobering thought. We have mandates on paper, but empty food warehouses on the ground.
Precisely. And that gap between what we ask them to do and what we actually give them to do it is where the danger lies.
Okay, let's move to our third bucket. Unexpected shifts in strategy and diplomacy. We are going to bounce around a bit here, from Afghanistan to Cyprus, and then look ahead to Gaza.
Let's start with Afghanistan. It's technically a political mission, Unoma, but there was a flash of violence this week that was highly significant.
Yeah, the report mentions the events of February 21st and 22nd, Pakistani military airstrikes in the Khost and Kunar provinces.
And the toll was high, at least 13 civilians killed. This is going to massively spike diplomatic tensions in the region.
Right.
It shows that even without a massive peacekeeping force on the ground, the UN is still there bearing witness to these border conflicts. It proves that the region remains incredibly volatile.
But then we fly over to Cyprus and we get an actual rare win, a moment
That
of
is
friend.
rare to see, isn't it?
Yeah.
But yes, the UN force in Cyprus, UNFICYP, facilitated a major meeting this week in the buffer zone.
The Greek Cypriot leader, Nikos Christodoulides, and the Turkish Cypriot leader, Tufan Erhermen, met for the very first time as leaders.
That is huge.
I mean, Cyprus is one of those frozen conflicts that people just forget about.
It is. It's been frozen for decades. But a face-to-face meeting like this signals a real thaw. It shows that the UN's presence there isn't just about patrolling a fence. It's about creating a space, literally a physical neutral space where enemies can talk. That is the ultimate goal of peacekeeping, to stop the shooting so the diplomatic progress can start.
Speaking of prep and progress, let's talk about Gaza. This part of the report really caught my eye because of the sheer scale of the operation being planned. Indonesia is stepping up in a big way.
This is a look into the near future, June 2026.
Hmm.
On February 15th, Indonesia announced they are readying 8,000 troops.
8,000. That isn't a patrol, that is a small army.
It is a massive deployment. They are preparing for a potential non-combat peacekeeping role in Gaza, and they are moving fast. They want an advance team of 1,000 on the ground by April.
And the report mentions this is part of the Trump's Board of Peace initiative.
Right, that's the overarching political framework driving this. But looking at the mechanics on the ground, the focus here is strictly humanitarian aid, civilian protection, and reconstruction.
Why Indonesia specifically? What is the strategic logic there?
Well, Indonesia has the largest Muslim population in the world. Their presence might be perceived differently, perhaps more positively, or at least with more initial trust by the local population in Gaza, compared to Western troops or NATO forces. It changes the optics of the security presence.
It's a massive logistical challenge, though, moving 8,000 troops and keeping them safe in a post-conflict Gaza.
The risks are astronomical. The infrastructure is mostly destroyed, but it shows that the global community is actively trying to find a structure for the day after. They're trying to figure out who cleans up the rubble and who hands out the aid when the shooting finally stops. Indonesia is raising its hand to say, "We will do it."
So we have covered a lot of ground today, from the mines in Lebanon to the displacement camps in South Sudan, and all the way to a meeting room in Cyprus.
It's a study in contrasts.
It really is.
Yeah.
I mean, think about the technology and the tactics. In Lebanon, we are talking about high-tech drone threats and detonator cords. In South Sudan, we are talking about hand-to-hand combat training for women. And in Cyprus, it's just two guys shaking hands.
And yet they are all part of the exact same system. They're all fundamentally peacekeeping.
So how do we synthesize this? If I'm a listener trying to make sense of this chaotic week, what is the one thing that should stick with me?
For me, it comes back to the liquidity crisis we talked about.
The funding cuts?
The money and the political will. We saw it with the WFP in South Sudan. We see it with the withdrawal and cost reduction measures in the DRC. The world is asking these men and women to take huge risks, like standing 10 meters from a pointed rifle. But the world is hesitating to actually pay the bill. Peacekeeping is adapting to shifting geopolitical alliances, yes, but mostly it is adapting to being broke.
This is a tough reality.
It is. And I think it's important to mark your calendars. The report mentioned that Peacekeepers Day is coming up on June 2nd, 2026.
Right, with events in Lyon, France.
It's a chance for the global community to actually recognize these risks, to realize that safety isn't free. You can't order stability from a menu and then skip out on the check.
Which leads us to our final provocative thought for the day. We always like to leave you with something to chew on that builds on what we've discussed.
Here is what I am thinking about.
Go for it.
We have mandates being extended until November 2026 for several missions. We have new, massive missions being planned for Gaza. But we have food aid running out in April and troops withdrawing due to budget cuts. So are we asking peacekeepers to do the impossible with invisible resources? Can you maintain a ceasefire on an empty stomach?
That is the question. Can you hold the line when the supply line is cut?
I don't think you can. Not for long.
Something for you to explore and mull over on your own as you go about your week. That's it for today's deep dive into the world of peacekeeping. Thanks for riding along with us through the chaos.
Keep learning.
And we'll see you next time.